Good morning and welcome
Morning.
to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and cultural program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are joined in the studio by one of our favorite people, Idris Cooper Anifa Woshe. She is like the woman who is just like so multi-talented, so awesome. And wow, like, you know, she even has able to like work humor, you know, into something, you know, as serious as the kind of political statements that San Francisco Mime Troupe is known for. You know, that's why they open on July 4th, right? What better date to open up the conversation. So, Idris, tell us about Seeing Red, written by Rotimi Agbabiaka with Joan Holden. Is this your second year directing in a row? Because I know you go back with the Mime Troupe, but you're just sort of coming back with a bang as director, right?
Yeah, exactly. You got it right. This is my second year. I directed Walls last year with Rotimi. Mm-hmm. And this year, Rotimi decided to write the show, and they asked me back to direct it. So we've been back together again. The Danger Twins.
Right. Yeah, you all are so dangerous together.
We are. We hope to be.
Well, you are, definitely, and I hope you continue to be.
Thank you. So, Seeing Red. Seeing Red is, we hope, we're written with Joan Holden, and it's about the history of socialism, as well as about our current situation, political situation. And it involves time travel. So it's a time traveling musical. And basically we have a character who goes back in time to find out her history so that hope that it can inspire her to take action today.
Oh,
hello?
Wow, that sounds pretty awesome. Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome.
Cool.
So time travel like Octavia Butler's, you know, Kindred time travel, where, you know, the protagonist has to go back in time to do something, otherwise she won't have a future. Or time travel like, let's see, Octavia Butler, Sankofa, where the protagonist goes back in time, this time going back through the slave trade, the Middle Passage, and come back to sort of, you know, sort of be able to articulate her person and who she is and what she's here for better.
Yes.
Is it that kind of time travel?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's, I would say it's Sankofa meets The Wizard of Oz.
Woo! Wow,
yeah,
really?
There's a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of Dorothy's journey of really recognizing, well, and it's also Sankofa because it involves history, but really recognizing how we got to where we, in some ways, how we got to where we are today, and also how we, that actually exposes a lack of knowledge. So we decided to take on the big bear of socialism because we are in this moment where we feel like it's possible for people to imagine something that at one time in this country was very real, which was something that went a bit beyond, I mean, we haven't gone as far as other countries have gone, but beyond the two-party binary that we seem to be stuck in, and also to remind us of what it could be like. So we have socialists to thank for our 8-hour work day, our 40-hour work week, for demolishing child labor, some of great the suffragette movement was fueled by the Socialist Party. The labor movement was fueled by the Socialist Party. And at one time, I think there was something like 1,200 socialists elected to office in this country. So
really?
Huh. Yeah, we've done some digging and some history, and there was, well, there was Eugene Debs' bid for president in 1918. That is part of the focus of the show. Those elections that actually where socialists came close to being part of the fabric of the political culture. And then, of course, we have Bernie Sanders, who ran against Hillary Clinton in the primary for president on the Democratic ticket, but is essentially a socialist and who's a declared socialist, and also his supporter and ally, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who just won the big upset in New York, who is a member of the Democratic Socialists. So in light of the Democrats really pushing against the idea of any other party stepping into the ring, we're pushing the idea that it's really necessary. And it's happening.
Yeah. Wow, it's really, really interesting. And I know people who live in the Bay Area look forward to the annual Labor Fest. And it's it kicked off July 1st, which was yesterday. And it continues, and front and center under the music, theater, and art category is July 4th, as of my troupe.
There we are.
Traveling musical at 2 p.m. at Dolores Park with the music. Does the music start at 1:30?
The music starts at 1:30 with the Gorilla Band. And we've had fun this year because we time travel. We also get to time travel musically. And so we have gone back and picked up the sounds of the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And I find that really, really fun. Lots of clarinet.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
There's even a big dance number in this year's show.
Cool, super. So is the music original or and just from that particular period, or are you all, is the band bringing back some classics from that era?
Well, so the band always does original music. The lyricist, Ira Marlowe is our lyricist, and I actually really, really love the songs that we have this year. They've been stuck in my head, but I really have enjoyed the music. And so what character also at the center of the show is Joe Hill. And Joe Hill was a socialist activist and part of the labor movement and also a songwriter. And what he did was to take popular tunes that everyone knew and write political lyrics to them. And, you know, kind of what maybe we do, although the music is also original. So there are snippets of Joe Hill's music in the show alongside the original tunes that were written by the band and Ira. So I guess you could say a little bit of both.
So who plays that character?
The character of Joe Hill.
Yes, Joe Hill. Mm-hmm.
Is played by now as bad as people mess up my last name. His name is Andre Amartico. I think that's you say his last name. I've actually never had to call his family name. But Andre is a new actor to the Bay. He makes his San Francisco Mime Troupe debut this summer. And You know, it reminds me of me. When I first joined, he's very excited to be in the show. I watch him backstage, he's smiling and excited for his moment to go on stage. So it's really been great to work with a new Mime Troupe member on the show. And I think the audiences are going to really love him. And the other cast members are Michael Jean Sullivan, Mime Troupe veteran, and Lisa Hori Garcia, also a Mime Troupe veteran collective member, and Keiko Shimasato, who bounces back and forth between stage and costumes, but she's on stage this year. She's not doing costumes. And costumes are being done by Callie Floor. So we have a really full team this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about your early Mime Troupe days. Because I don't know, you know, the Mime Troupe, how long has the Mime Troupe been around? Are they 30 yet?
Longer than me. No, they're well past 50, my dear.
50. They've been around for a long, long time. Well,
yeah,
past 50.
I think the Mime Troupe has been around since 1959.
Okay. Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's almost 50 years.
Yeah, about
to celebrate.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just 1 year older.
There it is. So.
Yeah. Cool. That's amazing. And born in San Francisco?
Born in San Francisco, Ronnie Davis is the founder. And the history I'd always heard was that it was Bill Graham's first major managing job. So he was part of the development of the Mime Troupe. And I came along much later. I came along in 1986 or 7. It was my first Mime Troupe show. And I was very green and had just stepped off the train and was very blessed to have stumbled into the audition room and convinced them that I was crazy enough to run away and join that circus. As I remember, I didn't really have much of an audition. At the time, Jose Maria Francos was my roommate and advised me not to go in with a polished audition, but to go in and be silly. And so I took his advice, as crazy as that was, and threw out my polished monologue. And I think it was probably from For Color Girls or something, which actually got banned from auditions the following year. So it was probably a good idea for me not to do it. Yeah, I remember a list going around of auditions we never want to see again. And I think For Color Girls was on that list. And so I remember the phone call because I was working downtown, a really well-paying but dead-end and kind of evil corporate job. Mm-hmm. I was working for 20th Century Fox, which had ended up in the hands of Rupert Murdoch, and none of us were really happy about that. And so the Mime Troupe called and said, "We don't know, but we think we like you." The rest is history.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
In order to prep for this show, I looked at old Mime Troupe footage, including my own, and was really stunned by how green I was. I thought I was doing some really great acting back then, but all I could do was critique my performance and go, "Wow, you're talking too fast. You're shouting. Why are you shouting? You didn't make that transition. What are you doing?" But,
man, that's so cool.
Live and learn.
Yeah, yeah. So what was the production? Who wrote it?
The first show I did with the Mind Troupe was the Mozangola Caper. And it was written by Joan and Robert Alexander.
Oh,
you remember
okay.
him, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
he's brilliant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You've directed some of his plays, right? Yeah. Yeah. He moved.
I directed a lot of his
anymore.
Plays. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you name a few for people who don't remember Robert Alexander? He's brilliant.
Robert Alexander. Well, his big play was before we actually met. Which was, we almost made it to the Super Bowl. And then he wrote I Ain't Your Uncle for the Mime Troupe, which was the remake of
right.
Uncle Tom's Cabin. And Servant of the People, about the Black Panther
right.
Party.
Wasn't Michael Gene Sullivan in that?
Yes, playing Huey P. Newton.
Right.
His
right.
doppelganger a little bit. Yeah, and... yeah, and A Preface to the Alien Garden, which we worked on.
That was awesome.
I really love that play. And we debuted that play at Trinity Rep, produced by Oscar Eustace, who used to be at the Eureka Theater, who's now at the Public Theater. And, Oscar said yes to that play. Very smart man, that Oscar Eustace. And we had a great time working on that play as a cautionary tale, gang-banging cautionary tale in the mid-'80s. And then I don't know if you remember Willie Bop, Willie Drop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Yes.
I do.
Mm. Yeah, semi-autobiographical piece that Robert wrote. So, and that was one of my company productions. We produced that at the African American Art and Culture Complex when we were there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your production company is Black Artists Contemporary Cultural Experience, right?
Yeah, yes. And if I can find the folk, I would love to bring Willie Bop Willie Drop back.
Oh, that would be awesome. Awesome. Yeah, we need
yeah,
to work that.
I see tons of remakes in my future. Like Keith Atkins' work that we started with is also really, really still relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're about to do another Robert O'Hara piece, just warning you.
When?
In
where?
October.
Your company? Your company?
Yes, at Brava in October. Me
okay,
and
okay.
Kay Hende, AJ, Rosemi. October, October 17th, we or 18th, we begin previews.
Okay. I'm writing that down.
In
so
the
I'm in town and
yes.
everything.
yes.
We're going to have you
get
back
ready.
On for sure.
Yes. More political theater.
So is Robert going to be coming to town for...
We always try to get Robert to come to town, so
okay, yeah.
I'm hoping
he's
available.
He's so brilliant, isn't he? Oh, my gosh.
Yes, we do. We worship at the foot of the Theater of Choke. Yeah, we really, as a company, we really love his work and his no-holds-barred. It's right up our alley and in line with our philosophy. Of not holding back, not mincing words, and doing the difficult plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and your company. Oh my goodness, I want you to mention the other folks that some of them ancestors now who go back, with the founding of the company.
Well, the company was founded, yes, by me, Shirley Smallwood, and the late great Lester Jones.
Yeah,
very missed.
Know.
People are just taking to a new plane. There must be some big party going on up there. Because the folks are leaving here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There are a whole lot
mm-hmm.
that are up there.
Yeah,
you know,
I
want
to give a shout out to I want to give a shout out to Anthony Gwynn at Tulane, the restaurant on 6th and Market that has fed us for $6 to $10 for the last, 30, 40 years. And the owner I just heard in the mime troupe rehearsal, I heard this, that the owner, Anthony, passed away last week. And that a lovely, lovely man who every time I went, when I went to graduate school, when I was gone to teach for Indiana and I came back and went into Toulon's, always gave me a big hug and told me, "You have been missed. Where have you been?" And there's it's so important. Community is so important, and that's a man who really understood community. And all the customers that they had, he remembered and welcomed everyone. He got to where he could recognize my voice over the phone when I would order and know what I wanted. It was like, "Oh, hey, I know what you want. You want number 20, the crispy noodles was my favorite, still is. And I'm going to go over there today and drop some flowers off because my heart is really broken that he's left his community." And, you know, you know you live in a community when your heart's broken when the restaurant owner is gone. Like, that's community. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So shout out to Anthony. Rest in power, Anthony.
Right, yeah. And tell us again the name of the restaurant.
It's Toulon's on 6th and Market. You know Toulon's.
Okay.
The Vietnamese Toulon's. Restaurant on 6th and Market.
Oh.
Little hole in the wall. You know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. That's really important.
Yeah.
And other plays that have come out of your company are In a Daughter's Eyes by Adele Williams. And you just love Robert O'Hara. It's so interesting that there's a Robert O'Hara and a Robert Alexander, and both of them are brilliant.
I know. And I've worked with both of them.
I know. Yes. I know. You're like, you know, a director scholar. And then, you know, the Booty Candy was so awesome at Brava.
Oh, yeah.
And Zakiya, Zakiya Alexander's Sweet Maladies.
Sweet Maladies. Another rough play.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. On the Heels of Black America and the Hollis Mugley's Only Wish Plus Two. That was awesome.
All right, why did you get it? You've seen everything. I know.
I've seen them, And then Chain and Lace Plus to Mecca by Pearl Cleage. And then we already mentioned Willie Bob, Willie Drop is coming back. You should bring back all of this stuff. And Keith.
I would love to. I just worked with Carpetbag Theater Company in Knoxville, Tennessee. I directed a show called Dark Cowgirls in Prairie Queens. Do you remember that play? It came to what was in the Alice Arts Center, the Malanga Castle Arts Center. And so they got a grant to do a retrospective, to revive all their work. And so they revived every show that they've done and put it on for a weekend. And I got to go and redo Dark Cowgirls because they have all these really, these classic plays. And I started with Carpetbag when I was a child. I think I was 9 or 10 years old when I started working with them. And that was my first professional show. I was a child. I had one line. It was Alice Childress's Wine in the Wilderness. It was a new play at the time. And shares a part with my sister, which I hated. And I got to go back and do Dark Cowgirls, which is a play I saw as an adult in Oakland. And so Carpetbag came to Oakland, which was, you know, a really kind of serendipitous happening for me to go back. And this particular play, I don't think it was the play they necessarily chose for me, but it was the time I was available to work. So I go back and I work with people that I've known my whole life and who are my my strengths, actually. So the actors start in Carpetbag, like me. All of us start as youth and continue through adulthood. And these particular actors, one of the actors, what my father mentored all through high school and college, and one of the other actors. But I was always I found out that they had a nickname for me, that they called me Black Butterfly. And I found out that the reason they called me Black Butterfly was that I had left and gone to California. But I found out that they were always, you know, keeping track of what I was doing. They knew all the work that I had done. And I had gone back once before to act with them, but there was this sort of, rooting corner. It was like, you know, returning home and all these people who, for them, I was the one who went to California and did the thing. And so that was kind of amazing to go back and have your pink cheeks pinched. You know, I'm over 52, and they're pinching my cheeks going, look at you, you're all grown up. Yeah, just a little. Yeah, but they did a retrospective of their work, and I would love any funders out there who see that vision with me. You know, that's what the company, we all would like to visit that work. We're also busy making new work, so we'll see how that comes along. But we have next on our horizon an American Mall.
Oh, you
by
oh.
Robert O'Hara.
Oh wow!
You know that
that's
one?
Gonna be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You did the stage reading after number 545. You know, and it's so funny,
got elected,
you know, we talk
right.
about American Mall, and we're talking about this particular play, Seeing Red, a time traveling musical,
yeah.
starts this election night 2018 in Bob Square, She'll
mm-hmm.
Never Vote Again.
mm-hmm. Exactly.
A fading fortunes made this former Obama voter take a chance on the new guy promising change, Donald J. Trump. But it's 2 years into his presidency and Bob's still waiting to start winning. Tonight she's telling everyone in her small town bar that all politicians are liars, the system is rigged, and nothing's ever going to change. Along comes a mysterious stranger with an intriguing offer. He'll shore in an America where working people come together to demand a brighter future, where socialism isn't mm-hmm. a dirty word. He'll take her all the way to 1912.
Yeah.
So, and you are, yeah.
And so what's interesting is, as you were reading it, I thought, you know, halfway through it, you think he's going to show her an America of the future. But he takes her back to 1912. And my mother's here. And
oh.
my mother's, yeah. She and she's, my mother is over 90.
Oh.
And has seen,
wow.
a, yeah, my mother, it's interesting because my mother was always the oldest mother when I was a child. My mother was was an older. She chose to have children later in life, which was very unusual back in those days. And so she was always the older mother, and she's the only mother left of all my friends. No
really?
One, only one of my friends still has his mother, and she's actually not even in his life anymore. But out of all the friends I grew up with, my mom is left. There was one other mother left, and I used to cling to her on Facebook, and she was a great Facebook user. She used Facebook every day. She I'd catch her in church Facebooking, and I'd be like, Miss Williamson,
oh,
are you
story.
In church Facebooking? Shame on you.
Oh, that's
But,
that's
you know, another funny. Champion of my work out here, no matter how Randy, my page got with, you know, whatever was on it, penises or drag queens, and she would say, I'm so proud of her. She lived next door to me. But she passed away last year, and so and my mother's here with me in Oakland
okay.
now. while I've been working on this show. And it's been interesting to hear her talk politics. She's obsessed with politics. If I think if she could put her foot up Trump's behind personally, she would. And she's really, you know, at her age, very angry about the election and the way things are going. And not at all intimidated by socialism or communism. All of those things, my mother at her age understands very clearly as valid political stance. And I remember my father had some friends who were communists and just being cautioned about speaking about their political affiliations out loud in my elementary school, because, you know, I talk. My father's like, don't be running your mouth. But other than that, I think I was raised not to be a rabid anti-anarchist or a rabid anti-socialist. All of these political views, I was raised as valid political views. I'm thinking that may actually go back to my mother's own upbringing. And she was born in the mid-1920s. And her mother, I was asking about, you know, the Socialist Party. And she said, you know, we didn't. But then later on, she started to talk about my grandfather being a socialist, but also being the first person to vote Democratic, because the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and black people voted Republican. And my grandfather bailed on that early and started voting Democrat. I think my grandfather would probably today be an independent voter. I don't think he would have participated fully in the Democratic, the new DNC. So it was just interesting to have some actual historical perspective on the country as I was working on this play. Someone who's seen quite a few presidents.
Yeah, that is really wonderful. Wow, that's so great to have someone with that kind of perspective, you know, right there in the house, you know, as you are, you know, directing this creative work. Yeah, that's really.
And the Bay Area loves Grandma. She gets so much play everywhere she goes. People give her so much love.
Is she living here now or just visiting?
She's just visiting. I wish I could get her to move here, but she's just visiting. But I've been eating good. Unlike me, my mother has the energy to shop and cook. My husband pointed that out to me today, because I'm always like, if I got to cook it, you got to shop it. And he's like, Mama shops and cooks.
That's so funny. So tell us about you know, your upbringing, where you come from, because your story is so fascinating, you know, your mom and your dad. And I think you mentioned your sister.
I have really two sisters. I grew up in the South. I'm a Southern girl, real loud and country. That's me. And I started working in the theater really early. My mother was a theater person. She sang opera and she lost her hearing and was unable to continue. And so she became a librarian. And so I grew up, my father was a research scientist, so we moved around a lot. And I grew up with, you know, very modestly college teachers. You know, the show this summer is largely about class also. And, you know, the interesting thing about class I've always thought about was that when you talk about class, middle class, black middle class, especially middle class is a contentious one. Black middle class has always been different to me from other middle class. Like, what we consider black and middle class is actually not what is considered middle class by white standards. But the more I look at this country, the more I realize we have no idea about class. We're so obscured, and part of that is what's kept us from waking up, is this idea that we're middle class in this country, when all of us are workers. We're all working class. And my father used to say that to us all the time, because your parents are teachers, and you probably know this about the Black community, that is a good job. That was a good job. It was an educated, you were part of the educated class. But I was very much aware that my parents were workers and worked long hours every day for short pay. And I always balked at this idea of people always looking at us as if we had something when we really didn't. We didn't have a TV. We didn't have a washer dryer because we couldn't afford those things on a HBCU salary. And so as we are in 2018 and we started to work on this play, one of the ideas that I think, I hope people realize is that all, if you work, you're part of the working class. We have these things. We have flat screen TVs and nice cars, and we think we're part of the middle class and therefore have something to protect from the working class. When everybody goes to work, you're working class. And those protections that people are taking for granted or letting slide by will catch up to them. And you've been to Nigeria. Mm-hmm. When I was in Nigeria, I always felt like they were 20 years ahead of us in terms of politics and economics, that the problems that were being visited upon Nigeria when I was there last in the late 90s, we would begin to see in this country. And that's what's beginning to happen, which is an erasure of the middle class, a cutting back on an educated populace, fewer people getting educated. And I mean, the first thing that happened was we had rolling blackouts when I came back. Attacks on the system. But I think that's what we are looking at now, where teachers are sleeping in cars. You had adjunct professors in San Jose sleeping in cars. There was a woman that was profiled on the news from, I think, Santa Clara University, who was confessing to being homeless and sleeping in a car and teaching at the university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I really hope people wake
amazing.
Up to the realities of the class-based system that we have, and recognize the power the working class solidarity. I think that is how we are going to survive. The only way we're going to survive the next 2 years and possibly 6 years is to really, really band together and fight the way people did in 1912, across color lines, across class, and recognizing themselves as workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, since you mentioned Nigeria, you know, we think about Wole Soyinka and your scholarship and stories about him, you know, as a scholar, a playwright, you know, just a wonderful thinker. It's just awesome. And when I was in Lagos, sort of like Lagos, it wasn't, you know, Lagos is so big because, you know, there are these towns outside of Lagos that are still called Lagos. And there was this street where there was this art, and Wole Soyinka's bust was a prominent part of this particular artist. Yeah, and I'm like, when we drove by to the hotel the first time, I'm like, whoa, stop, I want to get a picture. And
can you imagine, I got a playwright?
I got the yeah, Yeah.
We,
and
I don't
it
really
was
think we
like,
have any statues of playwrights in this country. Not a living.
We don't.
You know, American playwright.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. When I saw him, I mean, you know, he's really distinctive the way he looks. I'm like, oh, wow. So I had my friend take a picture of me, and he was a Baba Lao, you know, holy man. I want him to take a picture of me with you know, with the bust.
Oh, I want to see that.
Oh, yeah, I'll surely.
Yeah, where's
totally
the August Wilson statue? Maybe there is one in Pittsburgh. I don't know about it, if it is, but I could imagine there might be.
Yeah.
Get that statue.
Yeah, they totally need to. And the art in front of the business, the person was, I think he was, he did landscaping and stuff like that. And so all this art was right out front. I mean, it took up, you know, a nice chunk of the whole sidewalk. He had like a long, he had these really great pieces. And one thing I noticed about Nigeria, you know, whether I was in Lagos, which has all these monuments, to, you know, to just to regular people, not to mention great people, you know, like the judge who was a kind man, or the sister who was da-da-da, and they have this big statue in front of the National Theater and Park, you know, of a tribute to women. It's just huge,
really?
And it's so beautiful and kind of abstract. Yeah, and then you know, we were driving up, because, you know, you're sitting in traffic so long, you know, I'm so happy there's art to look at. So, you know, from the airport coming in, you see all this art, and this church looks like Noah's Ark, and I'm like, wow, what great architecture, right? Driving up to Ile Ife, great art, you know, going to Oshogbo, great art, driving down to Bagdari, you know, where they shipped our ancestors into the West, you know, across the oceans. Great art. I mean, it's like all this. And then they have like these tributes to the children. You see all these cute children with books and stuff. And then in Benin City, you know, there's a tribute to the children. They have all these kings and other great men and women. They've got like the Orisha.
Yeah.
So, oh, my God. It's just so
They have
awesome.
Sculptures everywhere.
I know, girl. You've been to Benin City, right?
I have not been to Benin City.
Okay, well, there is this piece, and girl, there's traffic. It's like crossing the street. It's like, I can't do this. You see these little kids, can you hold my hand and help me cross? It's like so scary. But there was this piece that I was just like wanting to cross the street to get up close to the art. Like, you know, you think
risked
about
your life.
No. I wait and let somebody cross. Help me cross. Hold my hand. Help me cross. No, I'm not, because I was thinking, if you help me cross, then how am I going to get back on the other side, right?
Yeah, right.
I'm going to need some help. And this person just being kind, but they're not going where I'm going. But there was this piece. It was so awesome. And it was all these, it's life size, and these men are sitting around in a circle just having a conversation, and it's a big circle, and they're really animated, and they're all talking, you know, to each other. It's like maybe like 10 or so men just having this conversation, and it's a sculpted piece. It's like, oh, my God, this is like so awesome and meticulous and just really, really beautiful. Yeah. I just love the art.
Did you bring some back?
No.
Oh, see.
No, I didn't bring any back.
I brought back all kinds of little tiny pieces of paper that had art on it. I have one that's the size of a business card that I bought somewhere. But I just couldn't. There were things I couldn't believe on the side of the road. Lots of beautiful art.
I didn't see anything striking on the sides of the road, and I didn't get a chance to go to any famous marketplaces, because we were sitting in traffic so much by the time we got back.
You know, I bought art from people.
Nighttime.
There were always just some, because I was also traveling with some Caucasians. I was, it was pretty, you know, I was always visible. And there were always these guys running up to us, mostly men, and saying, would you like to see my art? And, you know, just, I felt like not declared artists like here, where they'd be, you know, they've been through the training or they're associated with a gallery. These were just regular Joes who were like painting on the side to make some money to feed their family, right? You know, it's kind of like I used to bead earrings. And, you know, for $2 or $3, you could buy a piece of their art. Now, I'm no expert, so I don't know if the art was, you know, gallery worthy or whatnot, collectible, but I did come back with some really beautiful paintings and drawings.
We like it, so that,
right, and it was beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow, yeah, nobody ran up to the car or me when I was walking with anything like that.
You were looking too Nigerian.
No, they were looking at me, and I was wearing, you know, some of the, you know, leggings and things like that, and they were looking at me like, who is she?
This is a little different.
Totally. In my hiking boots, you know.
In my
safari kind of had to block the sun because, you know, it's hot, but and sunny. Yeah, so it was just my friend and I, we would, like, be walking, and we'd be, like, trying to figure out the gazes, like, what were they thinking? She looked at us and from the cars, you know, because I told him, I don't want to ride. Let's walk down the street. He's like, people don't, like, walk a lot when they have cars.
People
they just
don't,
drive. I'm like,
yeah, that was the thing that always marked me, too. And I was on the campus of Ibadan, and
yeah, I saw your campus.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
People would stop and go, you're that woman who walks everywhere. You're always walking.
Oh,
or they would tell
goodness.
Me how far I walked. You walked from here to Mokala yesterday. And I was like, who
they
was
were really
watching me
attention.
Walk? Yeah. Yeah, one guy told me that I walk as if I know where I was going. He said, you walk around Ibadan like you know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, actually. I would talk about it in my show because I have this little weird deja vu thing where I've dreamed places before I've gotten there. And so I've dreamed the layout. And so when I got to Ibadan, I knew that there was a market just beyond the gate. And how I knew that? Because I had dreamed it. And I was like, if my dream is correct, there's a little shopping center right at the bottom of this hill. And I took some of my colleague and I said, oh, wait, we're going to go find this market. And they're like, you're crazy. And I said, I dreamed it. It's right down here. And you couldn't see it from the street, but we would go down this little hill and there were all these little shops, hair braiding shops and clothing shops. And people were like, really? And I had dreamed this part of the city.
Wow.
Can come in handy.
Wow. That's hecka awesome.
Crazy?
So, I was looking at your bio and, besides, you know, you hold this MFA and director from University of Iowa where you were producing Robert O'Hara papers, right?
Right. Yeah, in the academy.
Totally right. That's a great story.
Well, I keep getting thrown off of university campuses.
Right. Yeah, that's a good reputation. You just must be too powerful, right? You just be like making those Western walls fall down, like
fall down.
And prostrate, right?
Yeah.
But you don't have your piece in there. You know that wonderful. Play that you wrote and also performed in, because you're an actress and a director. Like, people see you popping up and stuff. Like, I don't know what you got coming up. You can definitely let us know so we put that, you know, in our calendar so we don't miss you. But, Yeah, we like see you doing all kind of wonderful pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And directing and writing. So tell us the name of the pieces that you wrote, the one particularly around, you know, your story about the black girl traveling. Was it in Africa or I forgot what it was.
Traveling While Black.
Traveling
everywhere.
While Black. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. You got to bring that back. I like that one.
I would like to bring that back. I've been invited to Philadelphia to do that in the fall. So
oh, nice.
It's still around. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, Traveling While Black. That was the show that brought Rotimi and I together.
Because
he came
really?
To see it. Yeah, I had just
I
reached out to him when I found out he was in the mime troupe and said, you know, and Nigerian. It was like, oh, you're all up in my wheelhouse. I need to know you. And I remember him coming to the show and getting all my little inside jokes because, you know, we both throw in things sometimes that we don't care if it's funny to anyone but us. What's that little joke is staying in the show. And there may be a one or two of those left in Seeing Red, too, I think. The collective, like, that's not funny. It's funny to us. It's got to go. But I think we kept a couple. And Rotimi was there. I remember he was sitting stage left at the end. And he was laughing so hard, like screaming laughing in the Bravo studio. And I just thought, oh, my God, who is this guy? Gets everything. He gets every bit of me. And we talked after the show, and that was the conversation. It was like, oh, my God, I get every bit of you. And I was like, you get me, you feel me, you read me. And we've been together ever since, kind of working on one thing or another.
Right. Nice, nice.
Yeah.
And
he was great in Booty Candy, wasn't he?
Oh, he was so good. And then his solo piece was so wonderful. And I missed him in Susie Laurie Park's piece,
Father Comes Home.
Yeah, I missed him in that. I didn't know he was in that. Yeah, hopefully they'll bring it back.
Yeah.
You know, one of our companies to bring it
back.
One
of our company members went to see it. She said she wanted to see more of him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Don't we all?
Well, he's just like, you know, there's nothing subtle about him. Even when he's so big, you know, like,
I know.
Yeah, like he might have this little part, but it's like, he's big, like he's not little.
Yeah, he's big inside of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He is,
and
it's been amazing to watch him write this show. And, you know, the Mind Troop is a collective, everyone has a say-so, and it's just been a really great process of, I feel like I understand genre more. I feel like I understand play structure a lot more. Just seeing it from the ground up and being a part of it. And, you know, working with Rotimi, I wish we had a little bit more time. I wish I'd had a little bit more time for writing sessions because we have these really great, really fun writing sessions, usually around a bottle of something, a champagne or a good strong red or something. And we get really loose and we laugh a lot. And I think that's where some of our really good work has come out of that process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was Jose Maria Francos was my director and, you know, he wasn't allowing me three glasses of wine before we rehearsed. Come in, we have 4 hours, let's get to work, change that, move here, do that. That makes no sense, rewrite that. And he, you know, it was great. I love working with Jose Maria. But with Rotimi and I, it's like, you know, pour the wine. Girl, did you see RuPaul's Last Drag? Girl, did you check that play out? And somewhere amid the talking and laughing, some things get written down.
Hmm.
And eventually we have a show.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it sounds really organic and fun, you know, sort of like following the rhythm. Sounds real African, too, you know, that process.
Yeah. And he worked with Joan this year. So that was fun, I think, for him, was to work and be somewhat mentored by Joan Holden, who is, you know, seasoned playwriting.
I think I first met you, you know, when with the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. That's my strongest. And then, that is such a wonderful organization. And I think, is something coming up this year with, okay, when is it?
With Medea?
Yeah.
There's a show in the fall at Brava that's running pretty close to the opening of an American mall somewhere.
Okay.
I think it's
okay.
In October. And I have to get to my computer to give you the exact dates. And I can send you that information, too.
Okay.
I'm sure I'll be. Yeah. It's going to be at Brava, and if I'm able to, I think I'll do something there. I still try to work with Medea when I can. I was part of Rebirth.
That was great. That was huge. It was like, you know, it was like such pageantry, you know, like it was just such a big play.
And they liked the monologue that I wrote. I think they're still performing it even without me. I hope they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great. That's really great. Wow, Idris. So are you showing up in anybody's play? Like, should we be looking for you at one of the local theaters?
I just did a reading with Camposanto, so hopefully some scheduling can work out and maybe I can make a debut with my old friend, Sean San Jose. I just did a reading of a new piece by, I don't know if I'm supposed to be talking about it, but it was really wonderful. We did an in-house reading of an early draft of a Paul Flores piece that, everything they do is relevant and wonderful. And Camposanto, I always think of Camposanto and BCC as siblings, because we both groups were really nurtured by Intersection for the Art early on. We were there in the 90s together, BACCE, and then Camposanto came right in and started. But we, before Camposanto was there, we were there as the house resident company. And I wanted to mention also Shirley Smallwood, who founded the company with Lester and I. And Shirley is still with the company.
Oh, okay.
She just turned 70, y'all.
Whoa.
Which she tells everybody.
Yeah.
But Shirley's she's been hosting. We've all hosted the Salon. So it's me, Shirley Smallwood, Kehinde Koyecho, AJ Mitchell, and Rotimi Agbabiaka. We are all the collective member, and we're adding Jenny Brick from Barbecue.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So all the
Robert O'Hara aficionados.
Yeah. So in closing, tell us about Salon, the salons, soul salons that we missed, for those who are just hearing it now.
Yes, Jaybone, anyone who missed these. They were really, really fun and community building. And we did five of them. We had House Full of Black Women with Amara Tigger Smith and Ellen Sebastian Chang. We had Black Benatar with Beatrice Thomas. And we did a salon reading of which we'll probably bring all of these back in the next season. We did a salon with of dangerous plays, band plays, a couple of pieces of Robert O'Hara's, a couple pieces of Robert Alexander's. Mm-hmm. And then our final salon was OMB, which is We Want to Snatch as our house band. And OMB grew out of the Sugar Shack. David Lofton is the guitarist with Blue Buddha, who's the vocalist, and I met Blue Buddha through David, their partners. And David was part of Sugar Shack. John and Bone, I don't know if you remember John and Bone and Beautiful Cuba, played some really wonderful music, and David actually found two CDs that were recorded at the Sugar Shack in 1992. The Sugar Shack tapes, we have them. And so we'll probably see more of OMB. Really great, eclectic, rock, powerful, political. And it was really a wonderful way to close the season. But we'll be back. The salons, as exhausting as they are, I was trying to retire them. I don't think I'm going to be able to, because they were so popular. They were a great way to build community and a place for people to go and relax and experience art. And we had Kay Hinde had her artist self-care kits, so people had scents and scrubs and sage what do you call them, smudges. So we had it was yeah. really kind of holistic and a little bit hippie and a lot BACCE. We're
really
all those
awesome.
Things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
and you know,
look
and it's really
OMB,
wonderful because
look for those salons. Yeah.
No,
I was
just
look for them
how,
to come back because I'm not sure what we're doing, but we're trying to. And if people have ideas for a salon, Idris at brava.org. Hit me up.
Oh, wow. Okay, I will do that. Yeah, I didn't know that it was open to ideas. Oh, yeah, I've got some ideas.
Yeah, we
okay,
have guest
cool.
curators regularly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it,
okay.
and this has came out of the idea of wanting to have another Sugar Shack, actually, quite honestly. It started as an archival piece, and I'm still working on that, of archiving the black art that was being produced, the performing arts in particular, that was being produced in the 80s, but visual arts as well, because Kay Vacante was back in those days, known then as Armin Walker, doing photography, and really creating an online, now it's moved to the online, archive of that work, as much of it as I can uncover and hold on to. And then there was just so much new stuff that we wanted to bring into the room, and we needed to open up that Brava Cabaret, the Brava's new cabaret space. Have you been in it?
Where is it?
It's part of the building where the storefronts. Where the boarded up storefronts
no.
were. They've been opened up.
No, I
you
haven't.
Gotta come down
no,
on and see. It's beautiful.
Oh, it sounds nice.
It's really
wow,
beautiful,
that's
yeah.
That's so awesome. And I just love it that you all own the building. That is just so
yeah.
so forward thinking.
The Mind Troupe owns their building. Brava owns their building.
Oh.
Yeah, it really, and the Mind Troupe just performed at Brava on Thursday. It's Friday night.
Really?
yeah. We're neighbors.
Yeah, oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's time. You gotta do it now. There's a lot of advocacy, particularly in the East Bay, for arts organizations to own their own building. But there's,
yeah.
the Arts Loan Fund in San Francisco is advocating for that also, and possibly looking at ways to help artists out to own their own space, because you can be kicked out now at any second.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so
and
true.
We've seen it happen. We've seen it happen too many times. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we are blessed in the Bay Area because we just received, my company, BACC, just received some great financial support from the Lainan Foundation and the Wattis Foundation. And I feel really, thank you. And a shout out to the Phyllis Wattis Foundation, who really, I feel like, you know, not only took a chance on us, but actually saw what we were trying to do and said yes to it. They really liked Robert O'Hara's work. And I think a lot of their support was based on the script and the fact that we dared to do it and that we dared to do Booty Candy. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate, you know, someone supporting this really raw, in-your-face, but necessary work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Mime Troupe accepts no corporate donations and mm-hmm. relies on the passing of that hat, and people are incredibly supportive. And I think this tells me that people don't need to be entertained. They want to be educated. They want to be challenged. They want to learn something new. One of the criticisms of our show last year was that we didn't really, you didn't learn anything new. Although I would argue that sometimes people haven't heard the last ill yet. They haven't really heard that yet. But there's so much about immigration and the gray areas that we don't understand or know. But I think this year, for sure, we set out to really educate and say something right to the moment. Mm-hmm. Just speak right to the moment, because this is getting deep. It's getting deep. And I've been educated myself, because I admit that I didn't really believe until now that elections mattered. I mean, I felt like, yeah, especially national elections. I'm a big local voter. I go in for local issues. But on the national front, I just didn't see the presidency as having that much of an impact on my personal life or having that much power over our lives because of the way the system is set up, or that we could even exercise a voice as a minority. Well, what we see now is a silent minority, they call themselves, really exercising power over the majority, and elections really do matter. And I'm sufficiently woke on that level now. I also think it's a wonderful moment, because I believe that if Hillary had been elected, we would be in the same morass that we've been in for the last 50 years, and nothing significant will have shifted. And with Trump, we can't afford that luxury anymore. We got to stay woke. We got to stay active. And we have to participate in a way that's not, you know, in between Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. We have to stay ready to be on the move and protect our rights and freedoms, because they are going away down the river. They're going to be shipped down river to pick y'all. And you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I really think it's an exciting moment, too, in the country. It's a moment where possibilities exist, and where you can talk about socialism and look at the history of it, and people really, really not think of it as old history. And really see the relevance of it for today, and not, you know, not relegated to the dustbin of history, but to put it under your arm the way Huey Newton carried, you know, the Red Book and the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
that we need to be armed with this history and armed with what the working class represents and the power that the working class represents. We need to arm people with that knowledge because there are more of us than there are of them.
That's right. There sure are.
Kajillions more. Yeah, and if Donald Trump can't be allied with other countries, we certainly can. And if my travels taught me anything, it taught me that the rest of the world can easily separate American people from America, the government. If I traveled during Reagan's era when he bombed Libya, I was in Morocco. I was in Switzerland for Bush's war into Iran and Afghanistan. And the whole time, I was able to speak independently from my government. I was able to be seen as a citizen in trouble. One of the best examples of this was when we were in France. I went to France with Word for Word. And everywhere I went, the minute people found out I was American, because it wasn't immediately assumed that I was an American, but the minute I opened my mouth, people would say, "Oh, Obama." And I'm thinking, no, we just had an election. And I went to correct a couple of people, and they were like, no. We don't recognize that president. Obama's American president. And actually, never heard a French person mention Trump. I mean, they were all about Obama, and they never they didn't automatically, you know, associate. So we go to Nancy. It's a little beautiful village, I would call it, outside of Paris. And as we were leaving, one of the people who sponsored us spotted the mayor. And so she says, "That's our mayor, really handsome young man," comes over to talk to us and said to us, "I hear you're having some great struggles in your country." This was right after the election. November, I think it was. It was right after the election. It was March, I think. And he invited us to expatriate to his town. He said, "Wow. Nancy has your back. If it becomes too much, you can come here." And I thought,
"Oh, that's pretty cool." Mm-hmm. Wow.
I hope that our allies will send in the troops when it gets to be too much. I hope they will remember what we did for them in World War I and rescue us before it gets too crazy. We need an Arab Spring.
Yeah, we sure do.